Law is a burning thing, and it makes a fire ring. Bound by wild desire, I suited up for a trial by fire.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this edition of the Justice Team Podcast. You're listening to the quick intro of Sevi Fisher singing Trial by Fire by original Johnny Cash. We can hear that later. You can hear it at the end of the show. We have a very special segment today. We have a very special guest. We have Mr. David Ball. He's going to talk to us today about the reptilian method, where things are going now. He's one of the world's greatest trial consultant. He's one of the most famous authors in the industry. I'm going to get a little more deeper into his introduction. But first, I want to introduce some of my co-host today, Ms. Brooke Bove. Can you say hello?
Hello.
And Brooke runs one of our litigation teams, also one of the appellate lawyers here at the firm. And we also have a true fanboy here today, and he is a new lawyer, year and a half out, already tried a case of his own as lead. Blake, he's a true fanboy of David Ball. So go ahead, say hello, Blake.
Oh, hello, Mr. Ball. Big fan.
Blake. And how do you do?
Blake Burchell. And we also have, of course, our luxurious bartender, Mr. Murat Janabehan. Murat, introduce yourself and tell us what you've served us this morning.
Well, it's just a pleasure to be here again. Today we have an old-timey classic cocktail that is known as the Old Fashioned. I got here this morning and I said, you know what? I'm in the mood to muddle a sugar cube. What kind of drink can I prepare for the team today? And the light bulb went out. And I said, let's do a good classic old fashioned. So that's what we're having today.
The light bulb went out.
It went on, but it might go out by the end of the episode.
Have another one.
Well, we'll be talking to the HR department later.
I do not see mine.
Yours is on. It's Amazon is on its way. It's one of those little helicopter things. Yeah.
Amazon Fresh will have it there within an hour.
So a little more about David. If you don't know, he's authored some of the most famous books in our industry as trial lawyers. He did The Reptile with Don Keenan. He's done David Ball on Damages, which is probably the most prolific book you could ever buy. It's in his third. It's in its third edition. David, is that correct?
Third edition. Yes.
All right. And we also have Theater Tips and Strategies for Trial Lawyers. David comes to us from North Carolina today.
Just a second. It's a little bit important. The update to Theater Tips and Strategies is called Theater for Trial.
Theater for Trial. David, what other? So are these trial guidebooks?
This is also a trial guidebook, yes.
And can you
Reptile is not.
Tell us all the books that you have out there, or the ones that are pending, just so our listeners, we get a lot of questions and want to know what are our guests listening to or reading these days. So I want to know which ones we have on their horizon so we can look out for them.
Well, as you said, Damages is the fundamental one. So if you don't have the third edition, the white cover of Damages 3, I'd say that's pretty much a must-have, if I may say so myself. Theater for Trial is an extremely useful book. I wrote it with probably the best skills trainer alive, which is Joshua Carton. We both happen to have very strong professional theater backgrounds, so we got together and did this book. And I was very pleased because he had refused for years to put anything on paper, and I finally got him to do it. So it's really quite an amazing thing. At least his part of it is. I can't speak for my own part. If you do missed cases, there's a book called Reptile in the Mist, which is not trial guides. That's through Reptile Keenan Ball. There's a How to Be Your Own Focus Groups. What am I leaving out here? There's other stuff. Those are the fundamental ones from me. Especially the Damages book. If you get nothing else, the Damages book is key. In fact, you'll find in the Damages book, it probably covers most of what people would consider the new approaches that have come out in the past few years. They all are kind of taken from what began in the Damages 3 book and in some cases taken little whole
off. So David, the original Reptile was written, what, 10 years ago, approximately?
The original Reptile was 1909.
Yeah, the original Reptile was 2009.
Come a long, long way since then for a variety of reasons. One, the neurosciences and my direct involvement in it, we're doing a National Science Foundation project right now. My actual involvement in it has gotten the whole thing much, much, I don't want to say more sophisticated, but much more accurate and dead on in terms of what makes jurors decide things the way we want. How do we make up the jurors' minds? And the other thing is, you know, we've had 10 years of field testing, that's called trials, along with all the research going on behind it. So it's the fundamental stuff is still basically there, but it has come an enormous way by now. I don't particularly market myself anymore as just a reptile person because there's so vastly much more than that.
The reptile theory, it is neuroscience. I mean, it's science, right?
Well, it starts with anything about decision making is neuroscience. It started with a theory about the brain that anatomically is totally bogus, but functionally is dead on. And that is the purpose of the brain is it's a defense, protection, survival tool. That's the only reason we have a brain. That's the only reason we have anything. Hands, feet, the ability to talk, all that stuff. We evolved solely so that we'd be more likely to survive, or that we would, in fact, be the fittest compared to the other species to survive in the particular environments we were in. If you don't buy into evolution, you probably shouldn't tell me that, but if you don't buy into evolution, if you prefer what I think is the most hysterically named thing in the world, intelligent design, there's almost anything in the world that we've made is more intelligent than the design of the human body. However, if you prefer intelligent design, it doesn't make any difference. How it functions is still the same thing. The brain is there to protect us. The brain is there to help our survival. So when we frame our cases in terms of matching what the brain exists to do, we're talking directly to the most fundamental controlling parts of the brain. That's part A of the reptile theory in a nutshell. Part B is to show the jurors how the consequences of how the negligence in this case, or whatever the tort was, how the bad act in this case is the kind of thing that, if it's allowed to get a pass when it gets to trial, increases the danger everyone is in. So the reptile, that whole approach, gives the jurors what they feel, and it is true, as a palpable chance to make their world safer. They're not there about justice. Jurors don't care about justice unless it's justice for them. Well, it is justice for them when it's a way that makes things safer. It's one of the reasons half the purpose of compensation, legally, strict legal terms, is to deter. And that's really what drives the jurors as much as anything else. In fact, it's why your clients come to you in the first place. Most of them will tell you one of the reasons they've come to you is because they don't want this to happen to anyone else. It's not just to get the money they think they deserve or the money they might need. It's also, they don't, like any human being, they don't want their suffering to be wasted. We're the phoenix. We want to make something out of it, that it's a fundamental human drive. So that, and the third thing is, I guess I combined two with the deterrence and the, is what we call spreading the tentacles of danger. I did not know when I coined that term that reptiles had no tentacles. But as I say, the science has come a long way in 10 years because now they have indeed discovered reptiles with tentacles. So I hope they're gratified. I led the way.
Are you talking about all snake?
No.
So wait, Blake, we mentioned earlier
is that the group with you're in brass knuckles with all snake?
Yeah, the all snake, of course. Blake, we mentioned, David Ball mentioned his book, Reptiles in the Mist, Mist Cases. Can you think of any, who are your favorite reptiles or reptiles in the mist?
I'm finally glad we're talking about it. I think exactly when I think of reptiles in the mist, you got to think of the snakes, right? Maybe bearded dragons come to mind. Maybe my favorite reptile, probably the T-Rex. It's hard to, a little throwback. Maybe a little alligator.
Wow.
You know?
My business card has got a tiny little salamander or some damn thing on it. It's not a Keenan or Don Keenan always liked the fierce image of it. I always preferred the cute little thing. Just don't screw with me.
I like it. So we have you to thank. We're going to ask Brooke because she does a lot of our pellet work and motion writing and these emotions eliminate. Every single trial now, the first motion eliminated from the defense is?
To prevent introduction of evidence or to discuss reptile theory.
And there's a whole slew of motions out there that can help you with that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I almost never hear of those things. Let's put it this way. If that motion gets through, the chances are about 999 out of 1,000 that someone didn't argue against it very well.
Exactly.
Yeah, for sure.
They're so absurd.
Yeah, they attach all portions of the book. They've attached like pictures of me at seminars for the reptile theory. And I was asked the judge, I said, "Judge, am I going to pull a rabbit out of a snake? Is that what we're talking about? Are you going to?" And the judges get it. And they say, "Are we going to really put a muzzle?"
The answer is, "Judge, if I say something I'm not supposed to say or do something, let's deal with it then. But I can't, I don't even know what all of the reptile, what are they talking about? They don't even know." But I have to say, there is one motion that was worded in a way that it mentioned Keenan and me by name a whole lot. I mean, somebody said it to me because my name is in it like 41 times. And I thought, you know what? When I die, I want that stapled to my tombstone. DRI, Defense Research Institute, still spends more time teaching people how to avoid getting nailed by the reptile than all the other stuff they do together. And there are a couple of consultants and some lawyers who have made really good livings by claiming they know how to deal with a reptile. Well, the fact is, if you do the reptile well, and particularly with the directions we've taken it in now, if you do the reptile well, there's nothing, there's no defense to it. They cannot defend against it. And when I read these articles, you may have seen some of them, here's how to nail the reptile to go to defense attorneys. I'm saying, please, please do what that jerk is saying, because it plays directly into our hands. It's really kind of lovely. And it's not... It ain't because we're brilliant. It ain't because it's tricky. It's because it's about how the brain works. The brain is protective. The brain exists solely, as I said, so we will survive. Everything else the brain does is extra gravy. It didn't evolve for that purpose, and it's not what it's there for. This plays right. All the neuroscience stuff we're doing now, well beyond reptile, plays right into how the brain makes its decision.
Well, let's ask you that. Let's jump right ahead, David. Where is it going? What is some of the research you're doing in neuroscience that is different from what you've talked about in 2009? How has it evolved?
A lot of it has to do with emphasis. There is a touching reliance on the part of attorneys in the power of logic. And what we absolutely know now that we did not, that we were, what we thought might be true back then, but now there's not any question about this. By the time your mind, your conscious mind, starts paying attention, starts considering, starts thinking about how to answer a question, how to decide something, by the time then the mind starts applying any logic to it, the rest of the brain has already made the decision. So now that doesn't mean we can't change our minds, which is why we still need logic in the case. I'm not saying get rid of it, but logic does not change anyone's mind. And easy proof of that, turn on your television and watch two intelligent, honest pundits on opposite sides of an issue. They are both 100% logical. As I said, they're honest. They're not the slime we usually have to deal with. They will never in a million years make any headway in changing the other's minds because they're using logic. Logic does not change minds. It does not make up people's minds. It's coming from a variety of other totally unconscious things that you are no more aware of as they're going on than you're aware of what's going on in your spleen right now. And I hope you're not aware of what's going on in your spleen, because that would be some awful disease. And that's what Freud posited, almost a couple of centuries, century and a half ago, is the unconscious mind is really the ruler of the roost, although nobody quite realized how much. Our conscious mind is maybe 2 or 3% of what's going on. And when it comes to decision making, it's right down there around zero until after the rest of the brain for a whole variety of reasons. So our job is, let's get a hold of what some of those reasons are and talk to them, so that by the time the decision actually comes in deliberations, or sooner if that's what they do, to make up their mind, that they now want to make up their mind our way. That's what we want to finally filter up to the conscious brain. Because if they want to, they will. If they want to, they will find a conscious way to. Let me give you an example. I have a friend, I think I used this example years ago too. I have a friend who, she wears $800 shoes. Now she wears $1,200 shoes. And I say to her, why in the world would you wear $1,200 shoes? Well, the real reason, the totally unconscious reason, or maybe she knows this, but probably not how important it is to her. There's something about her unconscious that just absolutely loves the feeling of being dressed that way. That is extremely important to her, that she's not even beginning to, she doesn't have the kernel of an awareness of how important that, how much that's driving her decision. So she's made up an excuse, a conscious excuse, as we all do, why she's wearing those shoes. And her conscious, she said, they make my feet align better. So my legs and back are better. So it's much healthier for my posture and back. And she's an honest person. She truly believes this. And it may be if that's what the shoes do.
David, are you talking about my wife?
Yeah.
Have you done some research yourself?
I didn't want to admit that. So
it's a self-affirmation. So logic is like the last step of the decision making. It's already decided, and then logic is just pretty much reaffirming.
Mean ignore the logic at all. It means we need to frame everything to get to the forces of the unconscious mind. I can give you one example, very concrete example. And in fact, I can send you an article on how people can actually do this, or we can I'll tell people how they can get it if they want to send me an email, send to the thing. It's a way to start opening that we crafted and tested and worked on for a long time to get it to the point where, without your telling them how to decide, they come to their own conclusion your way with regard to something important about the case. Now, the reason we did that is because the thing we learned is, once someone comes to a conclusion, they tend to protect that conclusion. But once they come to a conclusion, not that some lawyer told them to,
but if it's from them,
we're emphasizing the point of, stop, for God's sake, stop, don't do it anymore. Stop telling jurors what to think and feel. They sit there and say the equivalent of screw you, or at least enough of them do to cause you some trouble. And any little chip away like that costs you money in the verdict. Even if it doesn't cost.
And what are some things that we can do? I mean, I assume, are you of the belief that the verdict is dependent on and usually formulates at jury selection and after opening, and the rest of it just fodder?
Never did until now. That was a totally bogus belief based on research that had been done in the 90s that never said that. And in fact, the people who wrote that research said, that's not what we said. We said the opposite. It depends how you do your opening. It depends on a lot of other things as well. I mean, in a lot of cases, yeah, people make up their minds because the other side is such a crappy case. But all else equal, if you use the process I'm talking about called alignment, then yes, you're winning your case in the first couple of minutes. And by the end of your opening, you follow how to do it. By the end of your opening, and this is with a simple little, minor case or with the most complex cases you can, intellectual property cases where it takes three engineers to explain to me what the hell the case is about, it makes no difference. if you can get the jurors to start to make up their own minds by what you tell them, the first, for most cases, what I'm talking about is something that takes a page. In very complex cases, in a very relatively complex differential diagnosis, failure to diagnose case, by the end of, I think it's 400 words or so of your opening, what's that, two or three pages, four pages of your opening, the jurors completely understand differential diagnosis as much as they have to. They understand it. We know this because we've tested it well enough to take it home and teach it to their kid. And I'm not talking about a bright kid or a bright juror. I'm talking about all of them. And they come to their own conclusion that the defendant physician violated the standard of care. Once they are there, you may be at minute four or five, three or four at that point. And then with everything you go on to add, it solidifies that more and more and more. By the time the defense has to get up, you wouldn't want to be in their shoes. And a lot of cases are settling by the end of opening because, you know, the room just feels so awful.
So, David, if people want to reach out, where do they find this, the opening topic?
Send me an email. It's jurywatch. Or, by the way, if you want to ask any brief question about anything in the world, not just things I'm talking about today, but anything, Artemis and I, I'll give you her email too, and I'll explain why in a moment. Artemis, my partner, Artemis Malikor, and I, love getting short answer questions. If they're more than short answer, we will say, you know what, we haven't turned on the consulting clock for this. Do you want us to do that? But most of these things are quick answer questions, such as where can I get that article, and I'll send you the article. So all you have to do if you want that article is put alignment article, please, in your subject line. That's all you have to say.
And what's the email again?
My email is jurywatch, 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 one word, @gmail. You also want Artemis, and I'll explain why. Hers is Artemis is ArtemisArtemis @consultmmb, like mother basketball. She's a sports freak, so that's how she says it. Artemis @consultmmb.com. And the reason I say this is because if you get into the habit of sending us, or if you ever want to send us a short answer question, send it to either one of us or a request like that. But if it's something you need an answer to right away, send it to either one of us, because send it to both of us, because we don't know, you know, just address it to both of us. Because if I'm like doing this, I can't answer your question. If I'm doing an all-day seminar, like I'll be in a couple of weeks, obviously I can't, or if Artemis is in jury selection or in focus group somewhere, she won't be able to answer. So put in the subject line, short answer question, urgent, need by tomorrow morning or whatever. And we'll do our absolute best to get back at you. We get a lot of questions about jury selection there, for example. Yeah. Now, a short question for a case that starts tomorrow morning about what can I say in my opening? That's A, not a short answer, and B, not likely to even be an available long answer by tomorrow morning.
So I'm interested to hear, so our bartender here is the only, well, he's a non-lawyer in the room. He doesn't practice in this. He's actually our CFO. He's also our bartender. But Murat, what are your thoughts so far? What are your thoughts about this neuroscience? And I mean, I just want to know what you're sitting here thinking about right now.
You know what? This is actually something that I'm really interested in, this topic, because I know as someone with an economics background, one of the things that a lot of economists recently have gotten into, especially someone by the name of Daniel Kahneman, is kind of how our brain is wired in a way, and we make certain decisions based on that wiring. You know, certain people are more likely to take risks because of this wiring. Certain people are more risk averse because of this. So I find what we're discussing today to be truly interesting because of this interest that I already have in this psychology of economics decision making. So it's really interesting to see how that kind of stuff could pour into the law and how it could affect the way attorneys speak with jurors and how the jurors' decision making could be affected as a result of it as well.
See, David, you're also solving the national debt crisis. You didn't even know it. You're going to be there.
when you combine economics with neuroscience, that's led to some of the most useful work people have put out. The book he referred to is called Thinking, Fast and Slow, Daniel Kahneman, and I forget the other fellow's name, is quite good. There's another one that I recommend highly called Incognito by David Eagleman. And then there are a few books about tribes, which these days, given the social divisions in the United States, understanding tribes is a huge issue because you'll have tribes on your jury. Jurors look everything up online. Some of them will. You can pretty much rely on it no matter
what. Wait, Dave, you're telling me even though the judge tells them you cannot go look online, you have to listen to everything in this courtroom, you cannot look up the lawyers, cannot research the topic. You telling us the jurors really do those things?
Well, first of all, that's the best way to get them to do it. well, look, again, this is something really important to how people think. You are telling them that something exists that they must not see. In other words, you're hiding something. And from the time we are old enough to open our eyes and see, the main thing we want to do is see things that are being hidden from us in any way. Mm-hmm. Now, that's a highly embedded drive, because anything that is hidden from us is dangerous, potentially. Certainly as we are evolving. And so we've maintained that today, even when we don't really worry about what it is. You watch a movie, there's nothing dangerous that's going to happen to you in the movie, but there's a mystery. That same drive is pushing you really hard. The drives we have today, many of them were developed when they used to be relevant and they're not now. Or take the sex drive today. It doesn't go away just because you don't want to have any more babies. The drive is permanent. It is there all the time. So the drives we evolve, such as uncovering what's hidden. So when the judge says you're not to do this, jurors, A, are driven to. And secondly, the reason they'll look you up personally, they'll see what's on your website. And I suggest you be really careful to examine your website in the eyes of jurors who might be leaning a little against your case. Look at it from that point of view, and you'll see how you're killing your own self by what's on your marketing website. You need to be extremely careful with that. It has cost people cases, not a few, that we know about. People say things like, just before deliberation started, I finally decided I'm going to look carefully at that website, and I saw what kind of people these are. They win all these huge cases. They yak about justice. They brag about how they do so much better, and they're wonderful, and I told him what kind of person he was. He's not obviously not treating us fairly, or he wouldn't be getting those kind of results. You've got to be really careful there. They will go there. You need to research, are there people with names like you, like your client, like your expert? They need to look up all the social media connected with anyone they're going to see on the case. You need to seize control the day you sign a client. To say, I will not sign with you unless you fulfill a requirement. And that is, I get to say whether and what your social media is going to be starting 1 week before the trial. Now, preferably starting right now, but it's the jurors that I'm worried about getting there. Be careful you don't destroy anything on their website. You can store it and then put it up again later, but don't destroy it. That's spoliation. But I'm not worried about what the defense attorneys get. I'm worried about what the jurors will get. And they will get bullshit that has nothing in the world to do with your client. Or Artemis and I do these full-day brainstorming sessions. We call them work days. And during that session, she'll just sit there and do a very cursory glance online at the client's social media. And it's brought some cases, if not to a screeching halt, at least realizing, you know, if this gets out to the jury, you're dead. I know a case where the law firm lost what should have been a high 8-figure verdict because of what was on their own website. We explicitly know this, that's what had happened.
What type of things were on their website?
Well, often it's what I told you before. In this particular case, it was, guidance for people on how to properly do something, but the way they were saying, trying to be a nice survey, here's what you need to know if you're going to do such and such a thing safely, And what it said to do was exactly what the defendant had done.
Oh, dear.
So there's a six-week, really expensive case. I mean, really expensive to put on. Just zeroed out in I think it was about 40 minutes of deliberations beginning, because it wasn't just what it said. It turned the plaintiff's side into total hypocrites and liars. It meant every one of their experts was lying. It meant the attorneys obviously were flat out lying. So it didn't just hurt them on that case. It pretty much hurt their reputation as well, because word of this kind of stuff gets around. We did exactly what they said. I don't remember I don't think that was ever put into evidence, but it certainly could have been. If the defense had done what they should do, and I won't tell them, because they're the defense, they would have found this. They would have handed it to the jury. Case over the day it started. it's a menace out. There are three cases in chief. There's yours, there's the defense's, and there's online. And online has the biggest axe.
Wow. So let me ask you this. So many times when I'm trying a case, I'm sitting here thinking, jury, if you just Googled this issue, if you just went on your phones and Googled this, we'd win right now. I mean, is there an effective way?
That's what you may think. But before you think that, make sure there's nothing out there beyond just what you've looked at.
Oh, I mean, I just go, like, I do this all the time. I sit on Google all the time and just say, if I'm a juror, if I'm thinking, just Googling these topics or these experts, what's going to pop up?
The problem is you can't just do this. You need to have somebody in your office who has taken the trouble to learn how to be a thorough, avid, passionate researcher, that they are going to find this no matter what, who has access, to the sites, the paid sites that where you go to get extra information about people, for example. So you may not see about the arrest warrant online, but it's there, but you have to pay for it. So what I advise people to do is maybe get together as a group of, half a dozen firms, unless it's a large firm, you can easily, and sign up for those things, get somebody inside, or just hire outside people. Get a research librarian from a local university and pay them whatever they need an hour, which is not very much money, explain the case, explain everything that can hurt, that can do thorough social research, that can go to the dark web. And the reason for that is 90% of the jurors will never do that. They'll settle with Google and Facebook and stuff like that. Some of them will have a kid, and that kid will be in some kind of science school, and that kid can go to science school and get access, as people can at work, to every kind of research thing in the world. And then they're going to find things that are wrong. There's one medical college, those groups that's board certified. There's one specialty college that has put as many companies and insurance companies and medical people and all sorts of things. They put total wrong crap out online, and they put it under very official names. So they'll put something out there. I'll give you an example that's a real example, actually. They will say, a huge amount of wonderful new research that's really done properly right shows that vaginal births are far less risky and that C-sections are far more risky than anybody ever thought of. So before a doctor opts for a C-section, he needs to really, the threshold is very, very high. Well, that's simply not a true fact, but it's out there. You can go find it. And so jurors looking at that are now going to go back and sit in trial and listen to you say, this is the point at which the doctor should have stopped trying for the V birth and go to the C-section. And the jurors are going to say, no, I guess you didn't read what's out there under the banner of, and it'll be some
official. Well, how do we protect against that? I mean, it's out there.
The answers to what to do are the easy part. You talk with your experts, you get ways to, the hard part is find out what is there so you know what you have to protect against. I mean, it's like saying what happens when you do discovery and you do depositions, and they're going to say something bad about our case. There's no general answer to that. I mean, the answer is, let's look at it. Let's see what we can do. The same thing with what's online. There's an attorney here in North Carolina who has spent a year in jail for either possessing child porno or child molestation or one of those things that only your weird uncle does.
or bartender slash CFO, these things.
How dare you?
He got out of jail, and the North Carolina bar and its infinite wisdom restored his license, apparently. Now, this is all just what I've heard, to the best of my good faith belief, so I don't get my ass sued by one of you people.
Free
but
speech.
The stuff about the online stuff is pretty accurate. He gets his license back and goes back into practice. Meanwhile, 4 or 5 counties away, we have 100 counties in North Carolina, 4 or 5 counties away is another attorney with the same name.
Oh, dear.
Ooh.
Yeah. Now, you can imagine when jurors start going online to look you up, because they are gonna, you just, might as well just as well assume they will, because so many of them do. And it's very hard for you to find out about it. They're certainly not going to admit it because they've been told not to. Although the judge rarely says, don't look up the attorneys. And what he really doesn't say, anyway, they find this out and then you've got a really big problem. The other thing they do, I started this whole topic with saying, they now look each other up. We're living in highly polarized times. I'm sitting there next to this person, we're chatting, and I wonder what he's like. I'm at home that night. I'll look him up on Facebook, see if he's a son of a bitch, hates Trump. Or vice versa. And now you've got a potential war on the jury. And the feelings are getting, especially with where we are as of this little session here now, that split, if you think it's wide, is going to get off the screen wide. The level of overt abuse and hate and anger and ill words and things like that. We haven't seen anything like that in this country since maybe Missouri in 1859. It's brutal. And on the jury, it makes it very hard for any jury to come to a unified decision.
Well, are there any things that we should be or that you'd recommend being on our websites and things like this?
Yes, there are. Finish your question.
On our websites or things that we should be out there. So if the jurors are researching, I mean, what are some things that we should want them to see?
Yeah, I don't want you to ignore what I just said about the split on the juries. That's at least as important. But on your website, you will know what's wrong with your website if you view it with a hostile eye from the point of view of a juror looking at it saying, I want to find out what's wrong with this guy. I want to find out what's wrong with this firm. I'm here because I'm looking for material I can take in and level a window when I get into deliberations, even before that. And now look at it that way. So that be careful with your marketing. We're not thrilled to get a $4 million verdict. We're thrilled at the level of deterrence so that the rest of the people in the world will be safer. It's that kind of framing. It's not the content, it's the framing. And the other thing is, the best websites are those that are not marketing websites at all. They get you just as much business, but they give people expertise who've had the kind of injuries that the kind of clients you're hoping to get will have had. For example, I don't know if it's still there. This is years ago. I can't remember the name of the site, but somebody whose loved one is now dealing with brain damage, whether traumatic or from some other reason, you know, oxygen deprivation, somebody now dealing with brain damage in the family, if they search brain damage to find out more about it, which most people now do, or many people now do, they get to this website in the first 4 or 5 things on the list of Google page, because that's what some people know how to get you to do. And it's nothing but help and assistance and guidance. There's a little sort of, by the way, if you need an attorney for any legal matters concerning these things, here's who brought you this website. But it's very subtle. They'll find it if they're looking for you. But it's not a big, you know, oh, and by the way, here's our number, save your kid's brain, 1-800-SAVE-YOUR-BRAIN. Things that help. Look at chapter 9 in the damages book. It'll give you a lot of help with what should be on your website, what you should be doing in your community, and that sort of thing.
That's chapter 9, third edition.
Yeah, third edition. People will trust you when they see that you do good things that don't help you, and even better, that you do good things that are counter to your interest. And that's easy in your business. The good things you do is try to keep the world safe, not just by these verdicts, because I know that that's not why you're doing the trials. You're not doing that to keep the world safe. You're doing that because you're getting a bunch of money. On the other hand, if you're also doing things to keep the world safe, you're getting fewer clients. You can say, we don't want to meet you as a client. We want to pass you on the street as a healthy stranger, is what we want. Now, you do that in a way that's believable. You actually do things. Don Kena did something brilliant in the years before he had enough. He'd been in the business long enough to have any money to do anything. And I thought this was one of the, and anyone can do a version of this. He printed up a bunch of brochures like that. You know, this is one of these things, if you open all three ways, it's a big piece of paper, but you cut them after you're printing, you slice them to three, so each page gives you one. Or you can just go ahead and pay my electricity bill.
I thought that was a jury summons for a second.
And
there.
On the okay. top of it, no, it's just exactly a light bill. I'll turn it the other way so it's black, in case I don't want to embarrass how much electricity I eat. At the top, it says something about make sure your kid's playground is safe. Top 10 things to look at, or top 5 things to look at in your kid's playground. If the answer, yes, no, yes, no, yes, no, yes, no. If the answer to any of these things is no, you need to get in contact with whoever is in charge of that playground and have it fixed tonight before they have to go there tomorrow. A branch hanging overhead that's dead that could fall tomorrow. So when is soon enough to fix it? Now, before the kids use the place again. Anyway, that sort of thing. And if the person doesn't respond, go to their boss. If none of that works, with schools, for example, go to the Board of Education or the superintendent. If that doesn't work, go to the helplines on the newspaper. And if that doesn't work, don't let your kid in that playground. That kind of advice. And then it said, and then what he did with these, I mean, he made stacks of them, but you're printing them three up. So they're costing a penny or penny and a half a piece on your own copy, or probably cheaper someplace else. And he printed up thousands and thousands of them. And he went around to children's clothing stores and Kmarts and Walmarts and places where people come who have children. And of course, the stores all loved having them. This is a great service. And it just said at the bottom, you know, to show that this was valid stuff, not to troll for clients. Kenan Law Firm. I don't even know if he put his phone. Now, if somebody, he might have, I don't remember, you don't need to. If somebody who has seen one of these things, either themselves suddenly needs a lawyer because of something like that happened, or a friend of theirs did, or they hear about it, who are they going to call? So what he's got for maybe $100, $500 in a huge city, he was in Atlanta, maybe it was $300 or $400, I don't know, is the best possible marketing you can have. It heavily outweighs the one-to-one effectiveness, and it sits around. It goes on the refrigerator. Unlike the TV ad that if you're going to see it again, you got to pay another $1,000 or whatever. That's what I want on your website. Just make sure there's nothing on there that's going to contradict what your lawsuit's going to be. For example, if there was a while somebody had a car, said if you and I had suggested this without realizing what a lousy suggestion it was. Here are the safest cars to buy if you have children, the safest used cars. And it was a handy list of the safest used cars. Well, if you're then going to do a products liability case against one of those cars, you better get that off your website. Yeah, the internet is so integral, and it is trusted in idiotic levels of ways by all of us. And this is another thing the neurosciences are learning, is that we trust there are ways to set things up so that they look authoritative. And we therefore trust them. The internet, all that nice type, the even stuff, the graphics laid out just so, the you know, all that stuff. The word authoritative was coined because it meant author. In other words, somebody who wrote a book, something with all those neat little authoritative looking lines, they knew what they were talking about. That makes it authoritative. so that sort of thing is very important. There's one other area, let me segue into, because it's also important. We're getting to the point where you'd better learn how to show the jurors that, and the judge, that the science being used by the defense experts, that the science they're using is bad science. And you need to learn how to show it in ways that Bubba will completely understand. That does not fly over the head of a 14-year-old kid of average intelligence, which you can do. In fact, the closer you stick to the law and to the rules of science, the easier it is to do. The first manifestation of that will be in a book that I'm doing with you might know a lawyer named Nick Rowley, who's probably the best of his generation, probably by far. And I don't really know people who compare very well with him of any generation.
And we had Nick on a few weeks ago. And we also know, I mean, for our listeners, David Ball's very active on Nick Rowley's website called Trial by Human on the listserv, answers a lot of questions. We have attorneys all over the country and some of the world that ask questions and get real-time feedback from
lawyers. It's a really interesting website. Well, Nick and I and Nick's wife, Courtney, and my partner Artemis are doing a book called Damages, the Evolution. And the design of this will be such that you don't throw out Damages 3, because that's still the main reference. This will be what have been, the very question you asked, is a good question you asked in the beginning. Where's the reptile? Well, where's this whole approach toward damages that incorporates the reptile? Reptile's part of that. Where has that, what's happened with that since 2009 or 10 when Damages 3 came out? So that will have a chapter in it by somebody that you can actually contact now for help. He may even have an article or something he can send you. There's a neuroscientist that I do a lot of work with, and we've become very good friends, named, you probably want to write this down because the case will come up where this gets important. You know, when you get crap like malingering or bad, just the independent medical examiner who's not. Yes. There's three lies in that one title. Independent, medical, and he never examined the patient fairly. So three lies there. Showing they're wrong is not enough. To bring an expert and explaining why he's wrong is not enough. That's okay, but it takes jurors always into that position of we don't know which one to believe. We need to go beyond that, and we can. That's not hard to do now. We know how. But the ultimate of that is to show that the defense cheated on the science, but to show it in a way that Bubba completely understands it. Just like you use Rick and Pat's rules of the road for what motorist, for what defendant should have done, you're going to use rules of the science road to show what the expert should have done. And when you show the expert didn't do it, even though it was what was taught to him during his PhD or MD or whatever training, now he's violated the rule intentionally in order to cheat, in order to help this defendant get a pass. So what's he doing? He is now, and this is really big, and this concept of disrespect is one of the big things that answers your earlier question, what's come up with the neuroscience. One of the most important things to human beings is respect. If I disrespected you right now, even on this podcast, if I seriously disrespected you, you would probably remember it for the rest of your life. People watching it would be horrified. Even if they agreed with me, they would be horrified that I would do that to you in public. When an expert tries to mislead a jury, you frame that as, he is misleading. He violated the rule that he knew he had to follow to come to a legitimate conclusion. In other words, he disrespected you by giving you stuff that you think you can rely on because you have the duty, use that word, to come to a fair conclusion. And he has disrespected you by interfering with your ability to do that. That is a serious violation, not in your eyes, but in the eyes of the jurors. It's like, who the hell does this person think they are? You've now got the defense expert not only wrong, but you've got them blatantly offending, blatantly cheating the very people, the jurors, who are going to make the decision. it's one of the most powerful new tools we have.
And I think that's important because a lot of our cases, what I've been doing is getting the peer-reviewed studies and studies written by the own defense experts that they forget is out there. And I've had impeaching putting into evidence their own studies that you walk them down the path, they're telling them something different that they approved in their own study. I mean,
well, first of all, you're often not lucky enough to have that. But even when you do, yes, that's among the best things we've been able to do. This goes further. You don't stop using that other stuff, especially if you look, this Dr. Jones here, he says right here in his own book that you have to do this step. And he didn't do it. Why didn't he do it? Because if he did that step, he would have had to come to our conclusion, not his. Folks, don't you think that if there was one doctor, one accident reconstructionist, one whateverist, anywhere in the country, anywhere in the world, who could have come to the conclusion they wanted without violating the rules of their own profession, without violating the fundamental rules of science, invented by Isaac Newton or Galileo or whoever the hell invented them, somebody else actually. Don't you think if they could have found someone like that who could really do the science the way it's required to be done, that that's who they would have had? No, they couldn't find anyone like that. Obviously, they would have had him here. Instead, they brought in somebody who was going to be willing to skip two steps, crucial steps, and I can give you one of those steps if you want to take the time to do that.
Yeah, let's do it.
One of the important, and to finish that argument, that's who they would have had here. Instead, they brought in somebody, and that's kind of a mark of the defense's disrespect of the jury. You have a sacred job to do. You swore an oath to do something to the best of your ability. In return, the system says to you, we will bring in people who will tell you the truth and be accurate to the best of their ability. When we don't do that, we're cheating. We're not saying anybody owns the truth, but everybody owns whether or not they're cheating. Those sorts of arguments get very powerful. Let me give you an example of something science requires. You must spend as much time trying to disprove the opposite side of the conclusion you're on as you do proving your own conclusion. The first thing you do is you must list every possible outcome of your analysis. And then you must try to disprove them all. If you understand completely what a differential diagnosis is, you're doing the same thing. Why? Because a differential diagnosis is the scientific method. You list every possible alternative, and you do everything that can be done to rule every item on that list out. If you cannot definitively rule it out with tests, you must, or otherwise, you must continue to treat it as if it is absolutely real. Therefore, if it's an urgent possibility, you have to treat the damn thing. You can't wait around and hope that's not what it is. If it's any, in other words, if there's an urgent danger left over that you couldn't rule out, you got to intervene between it and the patient before it hurts them or kills them. You don't get that step out of science because they're not treating patients. But nonetheless, you have got to work hard. So you can say, doctor, what did you do to find out whether you were wrong? What alternatives did you look at? And what did you do to rule out the possibility? Oh, I didn't need to do that. I could see this one was right. That is an absolute violation of fundamental medicine and of fundamental science. And you don't need an expert to say that. You can, well, you'd need an expert. Your expert can be a high school science teacher, or better, a community college teacher. In fact, often they are more effective than the high price spread from Harvard because they're local, they're trustworthy, they're not complex. Community college, high school teachers, they're used to teaching complicated things to people who don't particularly want to learn them. It can be very effective at this, and they're $50 an hour. And often, you can even suggest this, they bring some of their kids to watch the trial, some of their students to watch the trial. That gives them somewhere around 140% credibility.
And there's, you talked about the accident reconstructionists, you know, before, and engineers have a very simple premise, especially on product cases, that say, if a safer design exists, that's the route you got to go, right? I mean, it's a simple engineering principle. And every time I say it for Cross, like you outline, these are the engineering principles, and yet you're not adhering to them right now.
Well, yes, and in fact, you don't even need an expert technically to say anything more than a safer design. It's not whether it exists. Be careful. I'm sure you know this. Is whether it exists and is economically feasible. Mm-hmm. Is there something safer than my Volvo for me to drive down the freeway? Yeah, it's called a Sherman tank, but it's not feasible.
I'm stealing that, by the way. I'm stealing that.
Sorry?
I'm stealing that one.
And you also have another problem with that concept that you need to do some work with, and that is if you buy a really cheap car, you cannot expect it to be as safe as a really expensive car. So that's where the economic difference comes in. You need to do it the best you can within a reasonable range of the money you spend. Now, fortunately, almost every product liability design issue is really inexpensive to fix. But beyond that, the reconstructionist will come in and say, your own reconstructionist will do this. Don't let them. Most accident reconstructionists are failed engineers. They're people who couldn't get real jobs. Some of them are great. Mm-hmm. Most of them are awful. What these people do is they have their office clerk take the data that they've gone out and measured looking very authoritative. It is 13 meters and 22, say whatever, from here to there, and the dent is this deep, and is that gauge steel, and the wind is this way, and I farted over there. Okay, here's all the data. And they plug it into a computer program, and at the other end of the computer program, out spits the answer. That is bogus science, because unless you know exactly what the software is doing, you cannot cross that person's most important testimony. Now, unfortunately, in criminal cases, judges are allowing people in the prosecution offices to get away with, we tested the DNA, but the program that tested is proprietary, so we're not allowed to tell anybody.
thank goodness.
Well, that's legal.
In California, we now have the Sanchez case, which is law evidence 101, which is exactly what you talk about. Now the judges are up to speed on it. I mean, how are we able to attack the foundation of what you're using? So it's got to be excluded.
When they don't, it's also, you know, of all the programs, there's 17 programs out there they could have done this with. They're all validated as they were. Why did they choose the one that's proprietary, so no one's allowed to question it because of the job, right? Mm-hmm. The science things are very simple. They're simple on that basis. DNA. One of the things that can be wrong with DNA is that the machine that does whatever the hell it does was not properly aligned that day. Well, how do you explain that? All you need to say is what they're supposed to do, what you can do to align it with every use. You take a small known sample, your blood, your secretary's blood, your cat's blood, whatever the hell you want, put it in the machine next to the one you're testing. If your sample comes out for you right, then you can assume the machine is aligned. If you don't do that, then you cannot assume the machine is aligned. So there's reasonable doubt here, and that's enough in a criminal case. In fact, we've done pretty well with that particular argument. So the science, and this is the fellow I told you about, Pate Skeen is the name you want, PateSkeene. He'll be doing something in that book that I'm doing with Nick.
Let me ask you something else about experts to see your thoughts on it, because we talk about the reptilian brain of our jurors and the things they want to protect and the evil they want to protect against. I've been doing things where I'll ask the defense experts, you know, when you were in medical school or when you were an engineer, what did you want to do with your life? What was your passion? What was your goal? And then to show, walk them down the line of they never did what their passion or goal was when they were young. They did the ultimate betrayal and decided to take money for opinions. And I had one expert who was a quote-unquote billing expert, found out he used to do utilization review, and then showed the jury that this was the guy who was an internist that then is making the decision when we're asking our health insurance companies to approve a surgery. This is the guy. This is the guy that's denying. Yeah, so, I mean, for me,
Let me suggest a lateral move from that.
Good, I love it.
If you get the alignment article, you'll see that what you're asking not is what were your dreams and hopes when you were in medical school, is what did you learn when you were in medical school? And you'll ask, you don't need to ask it. We already know what they're, your own expert will tell you what every medical school teaches. So you learn every step of the differential. You learn that if you see symptom A, B, C, you must suspect infection. And if you suspect infection, you must suspect it. That now, this is what you learn in medical school. Everybody training to be a doctor back in the day, and you can say this, Mr. So-and-so, who's now the doctor, your defendant, Mr. So-and-so, when he and others were in their medical training, and you can say before a date, and that's the date that this bad thing happened, when they were in training before then, they learned, and you plug in what they learned that X is a possible sign of infection. Y can reconvert it. Z means it's really, really likely. They also learned if they see any one of these three things, they are required to assume that it's an infection until they can rule it out. If they cannot rule it out quickly enough for it to have a chance to hurt the patient, they must treat the patient right away. They learn that you're not allowed to send the patient home with just aspirin to treat the headache while there's a possible infection there. They learn that possible infection is urgent and sometimes an emergency, and since you can't tell, it could be an emergency. Now let's look at what happened in this case. Such and such a day, Dr. So-and-so, who's now a doctor, sees the patient, and you put this up on little charts within the article, explain how. He sees the patient who has A, B, and C, the three infection signs. He sends the patient home with aspirin. Every juror says, well, let's screw up, doctor. You never said the doctor did anything wrong. You didn't even imply it. You just said, here's what he learned in medical school. Here's what all doctors learn in medical school. And the doctor can't argue with that stuff. Mm-hmm. He did learn it. He did learn what you have to do. And he can't argue with the fact that he sent him home with aspirin. Tylenol. He's cooked from right there. He's cooked. Case over.
So how do you deal with a lot of these experts we hire are these run-of-the-mill, like missed cases, for instance, where they hire a doctor that comes in and says every time after 6 weeks, it's not related to the crash. And you ask them, well, at week 7, 8, you agree they're still in pain. Well, what's the cause of the pain to a reasonable degree of medical certainty? Oh, I don't know. I mean, how do you deal with that?
From your expert, where it definitively was a cause. The basic, one of the basic facts of both logic and science is that fact trumps theory. If the doctor says it can't be and you show how often it is, he's cooked. In other words, you have to look at how would someone come to that conclusion. And in order to come to that conclusion, this is what Pate Skeen will be teaching and does teach, is what he does now. He's both a scientist and a lawyer, and he spent a year at the National Justice Center in Washington putting this stuff together for judges. He's been working with attorneys on this. You say the conclusion is wrong. Now ask your expert, how could someone have come to that conclusion? And there's probably a number of different answers there, but what would they have had to do wrong in order to come to that conclusion? Well, one of the things they had to do scientifically wrong was to ignore some of the facts. They would have to ignore that this happens to people all the time. If you ignore it, then you can say it never happens. If you ignore the fact that the sun comes up in the morning, you can say it's dark all day long around here. What do you have to ignore to come to that conclusion? Oh, the fact that the sun comes up in the morning. That's a simple example, but it's almost always that simple. What did you have to ignore? What step did you have to leave out? What facts did you have to ignore? Otherwise, you couldn't possibly come to that conclusion. And then, since this guy is a doctor, and doctors are supposed to use the right methodology to get to the conclusion, or they will kill their patients, this doctor knows better. They're taught it in medical school. So if he left that information out, he had to know what he was doing. And then you go back to that argument about misleading the jury, and the defense is putting this guy on. And
love it.
It ends up that if you do this right, the defense expert is actually a damages driver for your benefit, because it doesn't just make jurors see that he's wrong. It gets jurors so angry that they're much more likely to go to a full and fair verdict. Much more likely.
exactly.
So don't give these people a pass, or the world will get more dangerous than it is now.
I'll keep calling this guy. So we're going to take a quick pivot, and Brooke's going to ask you our top. We do a top five or top ten every show, and Brooke's going to give you the top five in this, and then you got to guess. So you get three strikes, you're out. You usually do a Family Feud duo. It would have been you and Artemis, but now it's just you. Just you.
Not quite sure what I'm doing here, because the top five what?
Okay, Brooke's going to tell you. You gotta see if you can get all five. Are we at 100 viewers chime in, or 100 listeners answer this question?
Oh, you mean we're going to ask them a question and see how they answer it, and then
They've already answered it. We're playing the Family Feud. You have to get the top five in this, and Brooke's going to give you the category.
So tell me what the survey said are the top five attorney mistakes in jury selection.
Okay.
What are the top five things that attorneys do wrong when they're talking to a jury or picking a jury?
Okay, let's see. They talk too much.
Ding, ding, ding.
Can we get a ding, Timmy? Sound engineer. Oh.
Ding.
Does that appear on the list, Brooke?
It does. It's number five on the list.
Oh.
Okay. They argue with jurors or disagree with them.
You got it right. That's number four.
That should be number one on everyone's list. They interrupt jurors.
I think that kind
Never
of is included
interrupt
with the
a
argument.
Juror unless you are so pressed for time you can't help it.
I think that's
they
kind
base
of
con- sorry.
Oh, I was going to say I think that's kind of included in the arguing with jurors one.
So no, interrupting jurors. Not. It's just interrupting them.
Okay.
I'm tired of listening. It's disrespectful. I'm tired of listening to you about that. So I want you to talk about this now instead. This won't be on your list. This is extremely important. Might be on your list. You tell them the topic you want them to talk about when you're following up something they've said. For example, who here has been in a wreck? And their hands will go up. And like clockwork, every lawyer will say, was there a lawsuit? That juror is sitting there thinking about the grandmother got killed in that wreck, and some numbskull of an attorney is asking me if there was a lawsuit, and the juror's subtext awareness now is, this son of a bitch is trying to get me to sign up with his office to sue for that wreck. That's what he's asking me. Rather than saying, the question to always ask is, tell me about that. Not, was anybody hurt or what, anything like that? That's the question. And this four, the fifth one is you are asking them for a yes or no answer to things they don't really have a yes or no answer. It could be in between those two things and things they've never ever thought about before. So instead, what you need to do is say, some people feel this way. Some people feel there's too many lawsuits these days. Other people feel it's okay the way it is. And the blunder is to say, do you agree with the people who think there's too many? That's a blunder.
Because Let them pick.
Right.
It buries a lot of dangerous answers. Instead, you say, are you a little closer to the people who think there's too many lawsuits or something? Or think too much money is being passed on? Or are you a little closer to the people who are okay with it? Those are among the top five.
Well, that's
popular opinion, and thank God popular opinion can be off so often because that's how I make a living.
So, Brooke, what are our 100 other plaintiff lawyer listeners? There's a few others.
There's three more. One is that attorneys run from bad facts or they don't address them.
I don't see people doing that much anymore, but that's maybe because I've spent so much time with them, but I don't see that really.
Oh, you'd be surprised.
So five is serious or frequency, you know. But that is a big deal.
Number two on our list, on our survey, is that they don't spend the time to rehab bad jurors.
Though they do.
They spend too much time rehabbing bad jurors instead of just moving on to something more productive.
Yeah, I think what we see sometimes people feel like they have to win over every juror, and if a juror says what they don't want to hear, and they can get them off for cause, people try
that
to.
That is a big blunder, and what you want to do instead is learn how to do cause challenges. Most people don't know how. There's a way suggested in the appendix of the damages book. But the minute you start to win them over, you've suppressed the whole purpose of jury selection is to lower the threshold to getting the bad answer. And when you try to fix, that's the equivalent of arguing with them, when you try to fix it or lead them someplace else, the only time to do that when you have to, if you've got a judge who still allows rehabilitation, which is becoming fortunately less popular, You want to arm your people, the ones that you like. But no, that's I agree with that one a lot.
And I think the third one is just directly in line with this, which is you don't know how to do cause challenges. You don't know how to do cause.
Yeah. Well, there's a way. It's not the only way. And the damage book. Right. What you're trying to do fundamentally is, I will try to rehabilitate that juror that I know the judge is going to try to rehabilitate. Mm-hmm. I'm going to do it, and I'm going to do it my way, and I'm going to end them up saying, this is just not a case I should be on, and you can do that.
Right.
Yeah, this is if there's maybe a breach of contract case down the hall, might be something that's better for you, just because of your beliefs, and that's okay. You know, validify everything that he did.
But you also help confirm them. You don't say you're not good enough to do that. You say things like, once they've expressed a negative attitude with respect to your side of the case, generally, look this up in the book, you'll see it more specifically. You'll say something like, you seem like a person who really knows your own mind. Now you've made it a little harder for them to change. You seem like a person that even if I were to say to you, you have to change your mind about that. Or you have to completely ignore that if you're going to be a juror on this case. That would be pretty hard for you to do. And even if Her Honor was to step off the stand and come down and look at you and say, can't think that way if you're going to be a juror on this case. Can you be fair anyway? It means you have to ignore it. You sound to me like the kind of person who knows your own mind too well to do that. So there's a number of different approaches there. But yes, I would agree that the inability. The big problem is knowing what the hell makes for a bad juror. Another thing, I'm picking jurors on a demographic basis. You might as well cut your wrists.
So, again, if we have any, we just did the survey. If you have any questions, we can get them to Mr. Ball. It's media@justiceteam.com. You can also email Mr. Ball and Artemis directly with the emails that he gave you. So, Dave, we're going to wrap up here in a second, but I want the listeners to feel a little bit more like they've known more about you today because you gave valuable input. I want to know, what are your hopes and dreams? What are your passions and goals? What are things that David Ball is doing, whether it's inside trial consulting or outside? What are things that you're passionate about?
Right now, in the inside trial consulting thing, I'm spending an enormous amount of time, energy, and research on the kinds of criminal cases, that are putting so many teenagers in prison when they didn't do anything wrong. A kid will get arrested for something, and the prosecution not only does, but is allowed to trump up to the kid how serious this is and how many years he's going to go away for. So the kid, they've taken away basically the right to a jury trial by scaring the hell out of him. And in fact, if he goes to trial, he'll get what's called the trial penalty, which means he'll go to jail for a lot, prison a lot longer than he would have gone to if he'd just taken the damn plea. And what happens when you take the plea? First of all, we have no idea if the kid ever did it. We do know that many of them, if not most of them, are innocent. And even more than them would with a decent criminal defense lawyer, and we teach them how to be easily decent criminal defense lawyers beyond what they've learned before, that he won't be convicted. If it's not beyond reasonable doubt, you shouldn't be convicted. And the jails are full of people whose lawyers didn't know how to do reasonable doubt in front of a jury. I would say 95% of them don't. And I'm talking about some of the really good ones. Now they will, and I can teach it to them free and very easy and very quickly. Those kids spend time in prison. Prison is Harvard for crime.
For criminals, yeah.
Yeah.
Right? You want to learn to be a criminal? You go to prison. That's the equivalent of Harvard. You now learned about crime. You're now surrounded by some of the people there are, in fact, criminals. You get out, you can't get a job because now you got a prison record. What do they think you're going to do? And also, you're pissed off because they put you in jail when you didn't do anything or didn't do much of anything or you didn't even have a trial. Being in prison pisses anybody off. They don't rehabilitate anymore, especially these damn commercial,
Blake, what did you learn in prison? Anything?
How to make shivs. I think was the most useful. How to take any utensils and make them.
So you've got what you end up with is tens of thousands every year, tens of thousands of new people that we have turned into sociopaths and armed them to be able to succeed at it.
I agree with
you 100%. I'm not saying every ex-prisoner is like that. I'm saying the odds, especially if you're not white, plummet mm-hmm. that you'll be able to make it. you have to be extra. Look, when you see a kid has done it, the kid was in jail for 2 years or 6 months, but, you know, he's come out, he's made something of himself. We remark on it. That's how unusual it is. And, you know, God bless them, and some of them can do them. But they're going to go right back to the bad situations they had to start with, except now they're at a real disadvantage. They can't go to the McDonald's and get a job anymore. And we're turning out tens of thousands. It's destroying families, communities. And in my way of thinking, it's eventually going to destroy the nation, because you cannot have that many people disaffected from society, disaffected from, you know, our version of civilization, and survive for very long. That ain't gonna happen.
So we're out of time. Again, we ran out of time for Mauro Fiore, we were going to have on, but again, we ran out of time for him. Any questions, media@justiceteam.com. We want to thank our special guest, David Ball, for coming on. If you have any questions, again, hit him up directly. And ladies and gentlemen, what do we remember here? What's the tagline we say?
No.
Sleep till justice. We're going to have Sevi Fisher, trial lawyer at our firm, take us out with Trial by Fire, the rest of the song. Mr. Ball, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I fell into a burning trial by fire. I went down, 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 and the flames went higher. And it burns, burns.